Welcome to the TCE podcast for October 2014. I am your host, Richard Jansen Parks, and today I am joined by senior reporter Helen Tunnicliffe.
Hello.
Our editor, Adam Duckett, is currently sunning himself in Fuerteventura, so shall not be joining us. Unless we give him a phone call and deeply annoy him, which we shan't. Anyway, this month we are going to be talking about the efficiency of chocolate teapots, Denmark going green, and all of the other news from the world of chemical and process engineering, as well as recovery at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand, and how virtual reality can make you safer. The first thing that I think we need to talk about this month is news that BP has been found guilty of gross negligence for its part in the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of, 4 years ago now, is it?
Yeah, it was a while.
So this has been covered by lots of the mainstream media news type things, but just to give you sort of a chemical engineering side view on it and how it might affect chemical engineers and their jobs, basically BP have been found guilty of being particularly negligent, so that means that they don't just get the normal you've done something wrong fines, they also get the you've been wrong and you were a bad boy fines, which are four times bigger than the regular fines.
Ouch.
Up until this ruling, they thought they'd just be getting the regular fines, so they put aside around $3.5 billion to pay for it. If things go as bad as they can now face a bill of $18 billion, which is an eye-watering quantity of cash. Now, that sounds bad, and we know that BP's been selling off a lot of stuff and selling companies and assets around the world to pay for its bill, but it's not about to go bust overnight. Industry analysts say that this probably has the cash on hand, so don't expect any big changes, and especially don't expect any major announcements from BP until the appeals process has gone through.
So we're not expecting a big takeover offer from Shell or anything just yet?
No, though, you know, people have been talking about that for quite a while.
So really?
It's not, yeah, well, not Shell actually, but sort of one of the big American companies, so watch this space, I guess. Also talking news in brief, as I'm sure quite a few people around the world will know, I think it would have been quite hard to miss, Scotland has voted no to independence.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased about it, but yeah, we did a survey a little while ago asking people whether they thought Scotland should be independent. It was our Scottish members, and just 30% thought that they would back Scottish independence. So yeah, obviously there's a lot of chemical engineers, particularly in oil and gas in Scotland, so it could have had some pretty major implications for them and their work and stuff like that. But
yeah, especially with sort of big companies like BP and Shell both saying not so sure about this.
Yeah, it could have been quite bad, but fortunately the Scottish people voted no, so they're still part of the UK and it's all good.
Was quite a close vote, though, in the end, 45-55-ish.
Yeah, just 10% in it. So, but all they needed was a majority.
Turning to Denmark, Helen, you had some pretty interesting news from the CHEESA conference, was it?
Yeah, it was a big conference. It was the 21st International Congress of Chemical and Process Engineering in Prague, in the Czech Republic. Prague is a lovely city, actually. I'd never been before. But yeah, it was fantastic. But they had a few keynote speeches, and one of the most interesting was from Henrik Lundt from Aalborg University in Denmark. Now, his keynote speech was all about how Denmark can actually achieve 100% renewable power, which was a bit of a shock. So he thinks that can happen by 2050 with not really too many problems. He said it's going to need a holistic approach. That was a word he kept using. But it won't just be concerning electricity generation, but they're going to need to look at heating and transport as well. So the way Denmark normally runs things is they have a lot of CHP plants, combined heat and power plants. So these plants produce electricity, but then the excess heat is piped around the neighbouring area to provide what they call district heating. So rather than each house having its own boiler, this heat just goes out to homes and heats them. Now, in somewhere really cold like Denmark, that's a pretty good thing. It's also hugely more efficient in the first place. So this is already better. They're already building lots of wind power and and things like that. So that's doing pretty well as well. But they're looking at using, they say you can balance all these different schemes by adding things like transport into the mix. So obviously some of the excess power can be turned into heat. But then they were talking, obviously, running things like running cars on biofuels is obviously a bit difficult, but they think, or Lund thinks, that it's going to be that this could be possible if that rather than they use this excess electric power in the grid to produce hydrogen, not to store, which is quite difficult, but to directly hydrogenate vegetable oils to produce biofuels. So then transport can be completely renewable as well, because obviously you can't use an electric car everywhere, so liquid fuels are going to be necessary. But if they combine that into the mix, that's another way to bring in more renewable power. So yeah, he thinks that they can do that.
A big question, I guess, though, is cost. I guess that any country could probably go fully renewable within a few decades if they're willing to spend $1 trillion on it. Is there any sort of indication of how much this might cost?
Well, Denmark's economy is already fairly skewed towards renewable power anyway. The country, he was shown as a map of all the different wind farms on Denmark. It's completely covered in them. So actually, I think, and there's just so much, the focus in the country is so much towards investing in renewables, it's probably not going to be quite as disastrous as you might think.
Next up, in some rather surprising news, it turns out that fracking is much greener than we might think. In fact, according to some researchers at the University of Manchester, fracking is actually greener than virtually any other energy generation process. Now, obviously, this probably comes as a bit of a shock to us all.
Because I'm pulling a shocked face at the moment.
It works really well through the medium of audio. This is quite a surprise, because obviously fracking involves shale gas extraction. You produce a fossil fuel, which none of which are famously particularly green.
No.
You also, the fracking process itself has come under quite a lot of environmental criticism. So what basis really do people claim that fracking is greener? Well, what they've done is they've done a full life cycle assessment of the process. So they've looked at plenty of other types of energy generation, such as solar, wind, coal, blah, blah, blah. So they've looked at the environmental effects of the entire thing, and not just in terms of the CO2 emitted. They've looked at the acidification, they've looked at the effect it has on the sea, they've had a look at the effect it's had on water, etc., etc., etc. And it turns out that fracking, that shale gas production, isn't as bad as you'd think. In fact, it's possibly it is possibly better for the environment than straight-up renewable technologies such as solar and wind.
So, like a solar panel, you know, if we build a whole field of solar panels producing all this sunny energy, possibly not in the UK because it's never sunny enough, but in normal countries where the sun comes out, we can build a whole field full of solar panels, and that is worse overall for the environment than just drilling a big hole in the ground, pushing down a load of fracking fluids and creating some earthquakes and stuff.
Pretty much, yes. I know it sounds weird, because you see a solar panel sat there in the sun, you think, this is great, this is free energy just coming from nowhere. But in order to make that solar panel, they had somewhere had to mine the pieces that go into it out of the ground, they had to transport things, they had to use processes to purify things, and it turns out that if you consider everything, then actually just the process of, as you say, drilling a hole in the ground, sucking some gas out, is better for the environment in the long run. Now, this isn't to say that fracking will always be the greatest thing in the world. They did point out that the green credentials of a fracking process entirely depend on industry's practice. The positive findings that they came up with, they say, could be tipped all the other way if the wells aren't sealed properly, if methane is allowed to escape to the atmosphere, etc., etc., and that if things are carried out badly, then actually shale gas becomes worse than coal in terms of environmental impact. So this is a message we keep having around fracking, really, is that it's probably okay so long as we do it well. Otherwise, not so much. My final news story for this month is a little bit on the unusual side. Helen, I think you were having a look at this.
Yeah, I like this because it involves one of my favouritest things in the world.
And what is that, Helen?
Tea. I love tea. I drink gallons of tea. Yes, I'm British. I'm not apologising for it. So, I don't know how many of you have English as a first language or particularly British English as a first language, but we have lots of idioms in our language, lots of strange ways to describe things. Like if somebody's miserable, we might say they've got a face like a wet weekend, which is quite a good one. If they're looking really happy, you might describe them as being like a dog with two tails, because obviously dogs wag their tails when they're really happy. Yeah. One of the other ones, for something completely useless, is you would say it was about as useful as a chocolate teapot.
With the idea, I guess, being that you pour the tea and then, oh no, everything melts and you're left with a tea mess.
The tea goes everywhere and melted chocolate goes everywhere and it'd just make a dreadful mess of your kitchen. But there was a programme in the UK called The One Show on BBC One, funnily enough, which is basically a sort of magazine show. And one of the things that their sort of science bloke decided to look at, a guy called Marty Jobson, was whether or not a chocolate teapot is as useless as everybody thinks it is. And he did indeed make a chocolate teapot.
With disastrous results, or...?
Well, no. It turns out you can brew a cup of tea in a chocolate teapot. He went all the way up to York to visit Nestlé, where they've got a big development centre up there, and he met up with one of their chocolatiers called John Costello.
Chocolatier?
Yes. It was a job I would love. But I'm a journalist, so there we go. Experimented for quite a long time with, bizarrely enough, balloons, dipping them repeatedly in chocolate and letting it set in between to find out how many layers of chocolate you needed to hold boiling water. And then he made a mould in the shape of a teapot out of silicon, I think it was, and poured in melted chocolate and tipped it out, let it set, poured in more molten chocolate, tipped it out, let it set, until he'd got enough layers built up in this mould in the shape of a teapot. And then drilled a hole through the spout. Ta-da! Chocolate teapot.
So it's just layers and layers of really thin chocolate, right?
Yeah,
sort of act as insulation.
A really, really thick hole. So yeah, and apparently the trick is, because chocolate actually is quite a good insulator, so it's hydrophobic, so it doesn't dissolve in the water. And what happens when you pour the boiling water into the teapot is that the very, very inner layer of the teapot melts, but the chocolate doesn't go anywhere. So if you're not stirring and messing with the tea, actually this layer acts as a really, really good thermal insulation, holds the rest of the... So the rest of the teapot is entirely unaffected, and you can indeed brew a cup of tea for 2 minutes in a chocolate teapot.
Was there any news on how this tasted? Did it have a slight chocolatey twang to its flavour?
Well, Marty Jobson, I quote, said at the end of it, "Well, there's definitely a hint of chocolate there, but that's not a bad cuppa." So I would quite like to try one out now.
The feature on our cover this month takes a look at a pretty remarkable story of resilience, recovery and a determination from some chemical engineering educators in New Zealand, specifically at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. Now, in September 2010, Christchurch was hit by a 7.1 magnitude earthquake, which caused pretty considerable damage, but the real devastation came a few months later, in February 2011, when the city was struck by a 6.3 magnitude earthquake, which was pretty devastating. It killed 181 people, caused billions and billions of dollars of damage to the city, and ruined lots and lots of buildings and areas. And one of the areas that was hit was, of course, the university, which includes, obviously, the chemical engineering department, quite a lot of which was rendered unusable, uninhabitable for weeks, even months. This feature was written by Peter Gostomski, who was the head of chemical engineering at Canterbury. He speaks about how in the initial response to the disaster, they realised that they couldn't really teach in a building that hadn't been declared safe yet because of all of the cracks in the walls, and so they had to find a way that they could A, teach their students, and B, do their research without actually using their building. Which is obviously a pretty hefty challenge, and so obviously the entire university was struggling with this, and they used various ways of dealing with it. Some of the non-engineering courses, they sort of had a big marquee out in the grounds, and they taught in there. They sort of outfitted these big tents as basic lecturing halls, and after a few weeks sort of had AV in there and audio stuff. So pretty efficient.
At least you can't be hit by falling bricks in a marquee.
That is a distinct advantage, unless the bricks fly a really long way.
Yeah.
So they had to work out what else to do. And fortunately, through the connections of an academic, they managed to rent space at a high school nearby that had been declared safe fairly shortly after the disaster, but only in the evening, because obviously school kids were using the high school for their own needs. So they had to get their students to head into the school sort of after hours, really, so after between 5 and 10 o'clock at night to go and learn chemical engineering. I could barely be bothered.
That's dedication.
Yeah, during my degree career, I could barely be bothered to get into on a campus for 9 o'clock lectures. I don't think I'd 9 o'clock in the evening sounds even hairier.
Yeah, shouldn't students be in the pub by 9 o'clock in the evening?
But it does mean that they get to go to the pub at like 3 p.m. though. So
you know, it could make lectures difficult.
Swings and roundabouts. And remarkably, they were able to get back up to their full teaching program within 3 weeks of the initial disaster.
That's quite impressive.
It really is. But they still had the issue of dealing with their research. Now, obviously, while you can pretty much teach anywhere as long as you have the right materials, using pilot plants is tricky if you don't have any access to the pilot plant. So roughly 80% of the research space was out of commission for at least 5 months.
Wow.
After the disaster. Canterbury's gasification group's pilot scale a gasifier was out of commission for 6 months, so they couldn't do any of the research involving that. I mean, one thing that Peter says is that they got quite a lot of academics to just sort of say, can you try and do non-practical things, so just do a lot of research and into journals and papers and maybe writing up some papers during this period, because we've got a few months to try and sort things out. So along with doing more book-based research, one of the things that the Canterbury team did was sort of work together with other universities in that part of the world, sort of share the load a little bit, who hadn't been hit by the earthquake. So they're saying that one team went to the University of Queensland in Australia for 8 weeks to work on their biological research in their labs, because they needed a biological containment, which is fairly tricky when the walls have enormous cracks in them.
Yes.
One thing that comes clear from Peter's feature in the magazine is how much everyone came together to deal with this enormous problem. Not just people in the university, not just people in the chemical engineering department, but the entire city and the entire academic community of New Zealand and Australia as well sort of came together to help these people sort of try and fix what had happened and restore and keep the university going during its period of pretty much being shut down.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing's pretty impressive, really. One of the things that surprised me most about that article was just how bad the earthquake had been. I mean, I don't know what reporting was like in the rest of the world, but certainly in the UK, we didn't really hear that much about it.
I think it was that, you know, there's been an earthquake, it's pretty bad, yeah. Here's some photos of sad-looking kids.
Yeah, and it was like, I knew that the cathedral had come down and stuff, and they built a wooden one, and, you know, there's a few cars smashed and stuff. But one of the things that Peter mentions in the article is that there are whole neighbourhoods of Christchurch where the damage was so bad, it's actually unrepairable. They've just had to pay off homeowners.
Yeah, they had to say, we'll buy a house for you, you can't go back there.
Yeah, find another one. It's just crazy.
Also, the death toll. I didn't realise that going on 200 people died.
Yeah, that's a lot of people to die. And
for an earthquake in the developed world,
yeah,
that amount of deaths just shows how terrible it really, really was. Last month it was 3D printing. This month, Helen delved even further into the future and got to experience full-on virtual reality, though she claims that at least it has a process and safety engineering bent.
Yes, it does. I don't know how many of you have heard of Oculus Rift, these new virtual reality goggles that you put on to experience a whole new virtual reality world. It was bought by Facebook this year for $2 billion, I think. So it's, you know, it's becoming pretty big business. There's a lot of games being developed for Oculus Rift.
It's sort of like a mask type.
Yeah, it's
thing,
like a big
it?
Thing that goes completely over your eyes, completely blocks out everything. Now, I tried them on. They're pretty impressive. You put these goggles on, you look up, you can see sky. You look left, you can see out to sea. I'm sorry, you probably can hear I'm actually looking as I say these things. My voice is probably fading out. You look right, you can see a wall. You look down, you can see the floor you're standing on. They are pretty impressive things. But yeah, there's all sorts being created for them. But in actual fact, these virtual reality goggles are the future of safety training.
Go on.
There is a company called MMI Engineering, which has developed a computer simulation program called QuARTZ, which stands for Quantitative Real-Time Simulation. So what this does is that enables your little character, your little avatar on screen, to walk around a hazardous installation like an oil rig and experience a dangerous event like a fire in real time. So literally you will be your little person, you put on these goggles, you will be stood there on your oil platform, as I said, looking out to sea or whatever, and suddenly an alarm will sound. So your little person, it's all controlled with an Xbox controller, so you don't actually do any running down, you're just sitting there. But yeah, you can then run around and go and see where the alarm is coming from. There's usually a pretty obvious fire going around. What you then have to do is find the emergency phone box. Obviously, investigate the fire first, but don't get too close because your avatar will burn.
Oh.
Yeah. It's all in real time, so it will experience injuries as they happen. So if you get too close to the fire, you've got two little bars for first-degree burns and second-degree burns that get redder and redder and redder. And after about 2 seconds of second-degree burns, you just die, and that's it. So it's good sort of practice. But anyway, so you go and see what the fire is, and then you run and find your phone box, dial the correct emergency number so that whoever needs to know knows that it's happening, and then run and find your refuge, because obviously anybody who's been on an oil rig will know that there's a refuge area somewhere, so then you have to go and run around and find your refuge. But what they say is that this would help people in the real life situation, because this quartz can be completely engineered to look like your platform or your chemicals plant or whatever. So, you know, if somebody stood there, it looks like it is. People find their way around it in the same way. So it'd be really useful for actually teaching people how to respond in an emergency situation.
So what does it actually look like when you've got them on? Is it very sort of pixelated or?
No, the graphics are pretty good actually. Obviously it doesn't look like real life because it isn't. It's still a computer program. But it's pretty realistic, you know. Everything does look real. I mean, when you look out to sea, I think that's the most impressive one. You've got all these incredible clouds and you can see for miles and miles. It does look pretty good. Oh, and apparently you can jump off the side, but I didn't do that.
That doesn't seem like it'd be a very good idea in any case.
No, but that's just proof that it is, you know, they do try and make it realistic. You can't, it's not like a computer game. Your avatar can't suddenly jump for 20 feet in the air and catch onto a railing and climb over and stuff like that. It does actually behave like a real person. So if you jump over the railings, you'll just die. Or
drown. Or freeze because North Sea.
Exactly. As you would in real life. So it's pretty good. But it's all based, all the fires and everything within the system are all calibrated to real industry models. So if you know, the fire actually behaves as a real fire would, it can be affected by wind in the same way as in real life. If you stand behind a wall, it works out where the shielding is, but like I say, it's all calibrated to real physical models, so it's pretty realistic.
So is the plan to sort of sell this package to BP or what have you, anyone who's working in the offshore industry or indeed in an onshore chemicals plant? And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there is already big interest in actually using this for genuine safety training. It was exhibited at Hazards, actually, MMI and another company called Atticus Digital, who've got the rights to Oculus Rift and have been developing quartz to work with Oculus Rift. They actually exhibited this product at Hazards earlier this year. So yeah, there's definitely big interest in actually using it for genuine safety training, because of course one of the main advantages of something like this is rather than just sitting and boring everybody to death with PowerPoint or a really dull safety video, and let's be honest, we've all seen them.
They're not very fascinating. No. Normally,
if you're actually doing it, if you actually physically have to do it, you remember a lot better. You remember a lot more things, and this is experience and genuine research that shows that people learn better by doing than just sitting passively.
Even if the doing is with some goggles on and an Xbox controller in their hand.
Yeah, apparently so. It is pretty immersive, actually, because obviously I had a go on it. I was rubbish. I got lost on the oil rig. But my sense of direction has never been pretty good. So, but yeah, it is good. I also got that about 70% first degree burns, I think, but I did survive, so that's the important thing.
Yeah, that's the important thing.
I was hideously disfigured and had no eyebrows left, I imagine, but I survived.
We run a regular book review section that normally covers academic books, new textbooks, that sort of thing. This month, however, we took a look at something a little different.
Yeah. This month we had process safety fiction on the on the book review page. We did indeed.
I don't believe that's a thing.
It most certainly is. It's a book called Suffering the Fire by Barry Hodson, which is it's basically, as far as I can gather, it's a fictionalised account of Flixborough and then coming forward to Buntsfield. And it's what is this about? It's about a bloke who's basically trying to come to terms with his father's death at Flixborough, I think, and how that sort of affected him. But obviously it's looking at the human cost of the big disasters rather than just the process safety cost. So the bloke that reviewed it for me, a guy called Sean O'Sullivan, who works at Marathon Oil, we've got any Marathon Oil listeners, and he said it was neither textbook nor holiday fiction, but occupies an underutilised middle ground that explores the world chemical engineers know well. So yes, that unexplored middle ground of process safety fiction.
Fair enough.
So yeah, he said it wasn't bad. But I think he said the best feature was that the character traits explored as the protagonist reveals a need for revenge. Which, yeah. That's,
revenge?
Yeah, I presume on the people who let Flixborough happen. I don't know, I haven't read the book. I'm a bit sad that I didn't really, before I sent it off. And he said the worst feature was the unnecessary sex scenes which cheapen the plot.
I know, that sounds like a point in its favour to me. Maybe I'm just a bad human being, I don't know.
Unless they're just excruciatingly bad ones.
That is true. Those are not so good.
No. But yeah, if you want to find out what happens in a process safety fiction book, then go and read Suffering the Fire.
Well, do we know if that's widely available? Can we just go down to the bookshop and get it?
As far as I can tell, I think it's on Amazon.
Fair enough.
Or other good online book retailers. It's published by Killian Press, if anybody wants to have a look.
To round out the podcast this month, we have a couple of minor announcements, the first of which is a bit weird.
No, it's so, the best thing ever.
It's yeah. So, so a few months ago, some people from UOP got in touch with us, and they said that they have a pretty large scale model of a refinery that they don't need anymore, they don't want anymore.
It's really cool.
And they're going to throw it away, but they are more than happy for it to go to a willing recipient. So no price, no cost, just are you willing to have this in your life? Cool, then it's yours. The only downside I can see, because we've had some photos and it does look very cool,
so
very
detailed.
The only issue is that it's about 3 metres by 3 metres.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
It's pretty vast, so maybe if you have a basement, spare room, or if you're involved in teaching, if you have like a school or a training center, then perhaps it would make for a good
centerpiece, talking point,
training guide, perhaps.
Or that.
This is what a genuine process plant looks like. So yeah, if you are interested in picking it up, then you have to pick it up yourself from Guildford in the UK. Then please get in touch with Adam Crossley. That's ADAM.CROSSLEY at honeywell.com, and he, I am sure, will be more than happy to accommodate your need to have a vast model of a refinery, I guess. The other thing that we need to tell you this month is that you should save some space in your diary for the 6th of November, because that is the date of the iCHEMY Awards for 2014.
Yeah.
They're being held at Cheltenham Racecourse in Gloucestershire in the UK, and this year's awards are being presented by
Kate Silverton. She's a newsreader, a BBC newsreader.
So that should be great. We'll be there almost certainly.
I'm dress shopping already. I haven't found this year's dress, but
I need to buy a tux. I've lost some weight, so my tux will look stupid on me.
Yeah, it will.
Just now, I need to drop that fact into conversation really casually. Oh, by the way, I've lost some weight. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. If you have any feedback, then please get in touch through our Twitter, which is at TCU Today, or by emailing rjansen, that's rjansen, @ichemy.org.